One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Mainstream media's most wanted. KGRARadio.com.
Y'all, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. It's me, Cam Hale, and joining me, the man that needs no introduction, and I'm not going to give him one because I haven't had any coffee yet, but it is the great beast himself, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, folks? I'm here in the flesh in beautiful Skeleton Studios on a very dreary and cloudy day in central North Texas. I survived the state fair. We ate a lot of garbage. We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of paid for overpriced rides. And
how were the Fletchers? But, corn dogs.
I didn't have any this time.
Funnel cake?
Well, yeah, we had funnel cake, yes, for sure. I fell for it. I got honey dipped. this is a new thing, I guess, where everybody claims to be the best. Like, this pickup is the best pickup. You know, you see the commercials.
Yeah.
State Fair award-winning chicken tenders. Best of the fair. You're like, you know, so I was like, I'll try that. I'm going to hankering for some good chicken.
Let me hear your assessment of these.
Well, I bought them, and it pretty much tasted like they bought it at the Dollar General out of a frozen section and just heated them up. Because I was like, what a letdown. I wasn't mad, but I was just let down because I thought I was going to get some jam up chicken tenders.
Yeah, no.
Not so much.
Not so much.
But I did see some rather interesting fried foods, like fried lemonade and fried Jell-O and stuff like that. I'm like, I don't even know how you do that.
And why?
I didn't partake in any eating of that because I don't want to end up with cardiac arrest. But I did see several people. And here's a tip off. If you're so large that you have to rent a scooter to motor up to eat the fried Twinkie, you might not be, you probably shouldn't be eating the fried Twinkie.
Yeah.
I know it's probably extremely delicious, but you might want to steer clear.
Yeah. Look, I'm not a big fan of Jell-O to start with.
Yeah.
Why would you fry it?
I think it's a clever play on words. Like, they'll call stuff that, but it's not really Jell-O. It'll be just something fried that, like, tastes like Jell-O. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think it's a clever play on words.
Well, just because you can fry anything,
yeah,
doesn't mean you should fry anything.
No, but apparently at the Texas State Fair, it's very popular.
Golly.
You know, and then they have the opposite end of the spectrum where they're, like, using stuff to freeze stuff.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, like, you can get the, it's interesting just to see, though. I mean, I like to walk around. I think one of my favorite things to do is just the people watch. Like, I love looking at people. Yeah. You're like, what does that person think? First of all, here's another.
Do you see any fanny packs over there?
Oh, dude. Not only did
we
gotta
get them.
There was a vendor there that was selling them.
You didn't get one?
This dude had, like, I don't know, maybe 400 different types. I mean, literally, that's all this guy sold.
You're supposed
amazing.
To get us fanny packs.
Well, if that's, hey, the fair's still going on for another 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, you can get,
we
if
need
you
to go
want
there,
one, that's the
were
guy
there some
to
nice ones?
Yeah. But yeah. Back to the people watching, one of the interesting things is the people that missed the memo, there's normal people dressed perfectly fine. Then there's people that either overdressed or underdressed. And what I'm talking about is overdressed, like it was like, I don't know, 90 degrees out, and there'll be a dude in like pressed jeans, fully buttoned down shirt, and you're just like, where did you think you were going today? I mean, that cannot be comfortable.
Yeah.
And then there'll be people like, I don't know, a 13-year-old girl that barely has a stitch of clothes on. You're like, what? Who let you out of the house like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you see people that are dressed very, they may be of, well of age, but you're just like, do you really think that outfit fits?
Yeah.
Look, I'm no Abercrombie and Fitch model.
No, you're the before picture.
But I do know how to, I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know how to dress properly.
Well, that's, dude, you're stretching that.
I mean, shorts, a nice t-shirt, and, you know, some sneakers.
A nice t-shirt, and here we go.
No, but we had a good time. The kids really had a good time. They beat my wallet up pretty good, but, you know, it's a once-a-year deal, so I had fun. All in all, it was a good time.
That's awesome. And we got to get this thing started, because we've got a disc golf doubles tournament to get to. As soon as we get done playing, we're taking the Brud out again, because they want to play disc golf. So as soon as we get done recording all that, we got to gather up all of our stuff and head to the course.
Yeah, and then we're going to dinner.
Then we're going to dinner.
For your wife's birthday.
And then we're going to watch people get punched in the face tonight.
Yep.
So, all in all, busy day.
Action-packed.
Action-packed.
Last night, I was action-packed. I didn't know what to do. Bellator was on, the Cubs were playing, and the Stars were playing. And there was one other event going on, and I was just changing channels nonstop. It was nerve-wracking.
You don't go picture-in-picture?
Well, I know, but I can, but I need more than that. I need like four pictures.
I hate it. I hate picture in picture. I'm like, what am I? I can't do that.
Sensory overload.
I would rather have a TV on in another room and like run in the other room and watch a little bit and then run back than watch picture in picture.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, this, you know, let's just move on. Yeah. Cam, you need to check this out. Last month, strange reports of an unexplained howling noise came out of Scotland, reviving theories that wolves might have somehow returned to the British Isles after over a century of extinction. In the last few years, there's also been seen a spike in the phenomenon known as unidentified large cats throughout the northern UK. But now, new evidence is even stranger. A stranger creature apparently has turned up in Ireland.
Okay.
And naturalists don't know what to make of it. Mystery began when a rotting, half-decomposed arm was found on the shores of County Clare on the western shores of Ireland. Now, the individual who discovered this limb thought it might be human and decided to notify authorities. So, law enforcement ascertained that the arm belonged to an animal and that it was not human, and it was passed on to a guy named Frankie Coote, who's the Clare County Council dog warden. He's apparently the only animal expert around. Now, Coote immediately called the arm a highly unusual discovery for Ireland. Now, initial speculation was that the limb belongs to a large primate, probably a gorilla, given that the only landmass west of Ireland is America, and the discovery of a limb on Ireland's western shores is very odd. For his part, dog warden Coote is at a loss. He says, we're used to getting claws where farm animals wash up, or a dog, or a seal, or something like that, but this is an unusual one. It'd be nice to get to the bottom of how and know exactly what it is and where it may have come from. Now, there's other theories that the arm may actually belong to a large bear or seal, but for now, the arm is in Coote's freezer awaiting further analysis. So, this strange arm, and I mean, I'm looking at it, it looks like an arm of a gorilla washed up on the western shores of Ireland, and they're trying to figure out, how did that happen?
Hmm.
Did somebody have a pet? I mean, is it possible it died and washed all the way up from Africa? I mean,
no.
they don't know.
No, I didn't wash that far.
I don't think so.
No,
because of the currents and stuff, it doesn't.
There's no way.
So, what is this large primate? I mean, is it Sasquatch? I don't know. It's a large limb, and it looks like a giant primate's arm.
Sasquatch went surfing and got attacked by a great white shark and lost his arm.
That's what it looks like.
That's what happened.
Very interesting.
That's very interesting. I can't wait till they do a little DNA on it and really find exactly, you know what I mean? Like, break it down to exactly what it is. Maybe they'll know where this species come from, something like, I don't know. It's just, yeah, I'm kind of curious now as to how that got there.
That's the big mystery. Yeah,
I've got you something that's odd. From our homie at Phantoms and Monsters, Lon had this posted up. that came from a commenter on one of the YouTube videos named Mimi Joys. Now, you're going to enjoy this. I want you to listen to this. It's about a doppelganger. Now, I've always been kind of fascinated with the fact when people go, oh, I saw somebody that looked just like you. And then you see these people and you're like, yeah, we do look a lot alike. This is even worse, though, when you start talking about these doppelgangers. And this is what she wrote in. When I lived in another state, I had a friend say to me one day, when did you start working at the mall? And why were you acting like you didn't know us when we came in and were talking to you? Can't talk to friends when you're on the job? This is what her and her husband asked. She said, I don't work at the mall and I didn't see you. And they both started laughing. And I asked, what are you talking about? So they said, so you're serious. You're telling us that we both saw you and were talking to you, but it wasn't you. And then they both looked at each other trying to figure out if I was crazy or if I were, you know, if they were. So she says, a week later, another friend asked me if I liked my job at the mall. She wondered, too, why I was acting so strange when she came in to say hello. And again, I said, I didn't work at the mall. And she just looked at me as if to say, ha ha, you're right. After a third friend, and please note, these were close friends, asked me about my new job, I decided I really had to meet her. So I went to the store at the mall. But looking around, I didn't see anyone that looked like me. Well, as I turned to leave, I heard someone say, what? You can't say hi on your day off? And I walked up to them and said, I wasn't the girl who worked there. And they said, well, at least not today, huh? And I just said, well, see you later then, and turned and walked out. I tried catching her at work about 5 times and always managed to go in on her day off. Then, one day I thought I'd try again. I walked in, looked around, and someone approached me saying, geez, where have you been? We've been calling for you for days. Why haven't you shown back up for work for these past 2 weeks? The manager's mad, but he said if we see you, your paycheck's back there in the manager's office. I tried to explain that I wasn't their employee, and my friends had told me I looked like her. And the guy said, no kidding, because I can't tell you apart. The girl even has a mole on her cheek right where you do. I wish I could remember what her name was, not even sure if I ever heard her name. It still baffles me to this day.
Wow, that's, well, it's a little bit of good news, because isn't it apparently bad luck if you see your doppelganger?
If you meet them, yes.
Yeah,
so. But it's almost like this doppelganger was there and then realized, oh, they're looking, and then just took off.
That is so
but
weird.
How odd is that that you've, now she says these are close friends.
Yeah.
So your close friends would know if you truly changed jobs or not.
Yeah.
But when they saw you there and talked to you, and it's like, that's her.
Dude.
And sounds like her, looks like her. I mean, how weird is that?
I wish I had a doppelganger that would go to work for me, and then I would just show up and collect the paycheck. I mean, if I was her, I'd just go back there and take the heat from the manager and pick up the check and go on.
Yeah, just be like, okay, I'll get this check.
Yeah. That's what I would do.
That's your doppelganger.
Man, that's very unusual. And speaking of unusual, I told everybody for the last couple of weeks, I've been keeping up with this phantom that's being seen in Chicago. And it's still going on. Manuel Navarrete at the UFO Clearinghouse just posted another sighting, Cam. Get this. This took place on October 4th, which was just the other day.
Yes.
The person writing in says, I was coming out of Dulcelandia on Wednesday, October 4th, 2017, with my husband. And we looked up and saw what looked like a large black bat fly over us. It flew across the street and then over some trees. From what we saw, it must have been at least 6 feet tall and had wings that must have been at least 10 feet in width. It looked like it had bat wings, as they looked like they were part of its arms. As it flew over, it was making a very loud screaming sound and was flapping its wings as it flew over the trees. Now, I tried to get a picture of it, but it was over the trees in seconds and was gone. So, we walked down the block to see if maybe we could see it before turning around and heading back to our car. We saw it fly at another restaurant that we visited the next day and took down the information and submitted this report. You can reach us, you know, and they give out their number for privacy reasons and ask for any questions, and we're willing to talk about what we saw. So, again, this large bat-like phantom thing is seen, but it's very common. The sightings, either people are very clever and they're going on and going to the UFO Clearinghouse website, reading these accounts and then fashioning a story to copy it, or people are actually seeing this. I think that's the case, because it's always described as black. It's always described between 6 and 7 foot tall. It's always described as having a wingspan of 10 feet.
Yeah.
It's very common. Sometimes it's seen with red eyes. And another thing that's also, people see it screeching, making some horrible sound as it's flying over. What exactly is going on the Elite show? I did an article where talked about how a witch from the area believes that she accidentally opened up a portal a couple of years ago, and that's where these things are coming from, and she apparently is in the Chicago area. I don't know, but people are saying this, and it's always, and this, once again, this place that they were at, Dulcelandia, is located in the Little Village neighborhood of Chicago. So it's all taking place in the Little Village neighborhood.
Yeah.
Or parks, you know, close by.
What makes me always think that it's maybe, and of course, maybe I shouldn't even say this because it might jinx it and somebody else might want to do it, but people are notorious one-uppers. They always want to have the better sighting, right?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you have way more detail, way more interaction with it instead of, I just saw this winged thing fly over the top of us?
Well, you're correct.
So yeah. If it didn't happen, you know, it's almost like it's almost like the sightings that really did happen are very quick, minute, and odd and strange. And like we've always said, it's almost like if you go into way deep detail, it makes you go, come on now.
If it's really too good, yeah, you're like, nah, come on. Somebody made that up.
I don't know why.
But if it's vague,
way. Yeah.
Well, because if I think if it's vague, your brain just like fills in the gaps, and that's good enough.
I think you're right. Yeah. This comes from MUFON.com. Roger Marsh had posted this. Now, on the Elite show, I had discussed that red glob in the sky that was seen, and I really got a kick out of this because this comes from UFO. It's a green disc. So now we've got some odd colors at Poaki there in New Mexico. A witness reports watching a bright green disc-shaped object less than 100 feet off the ground. Now, we haven't done this in a while, so everybody get out your pen and paper. It's case number 81321. From the Mutual UFO Network. Now, the witness was driving with her husband from Taos County to Santa Fe at 6:20 p.m. on January 3rd of 2017, says when this incident began. Now, the witness states this, that I saw a bright strobing object heading south on the west side of the highway just as we were coming up to the exit for Los Alamos, Kyle, near Poaki, and the store and gas station, the casinos that are there at that point on the road, says they were headed northbound, and they go on to say that it was less than 100 feet in elevation, very bright green, and it seemed to be a spiraling or spinning pattern to it, and round but flat. I think it seemed to spiral on the bottom of it, but it may have been more spherical. There were no other lights on it, and in my mind, I tried to say it was a helicopter because of the spinning, but it was bright green, and there were no other lights on it. Now, they go on to say that it appeared to move twice as fast as the vehicle, moving along at 50, so moving about 100 miles an hour. And then the witness states that I tried to point and tell my husband fast enough so he could see it, but he was only able to see it in the back window of the SUV, maybe a mile or more behind us, over an overpass. He was able to see the strobing green light, but not the spiral or spinning pattern. I had music on and the windows closed, so I had no idea if it had noise associated with it. I was very aware that it was not explainable in my mind. Now, I had no frame of reference for what I had seen, nor did my husband, who could not explain something moving at that speed, so low and bright lime green. I was consistently looking for others or something to explain it. Now, we lost sight of it because I was headed north. And while I did have the desire to turn around and chase it, I knew I was not fast enough to pull a U-turn across six lanes. Now, the state director there in New Mexico, named David Hindall, investigated this case and, of course, closes it as unknown. But David puts in his report that the witness provided no further information. But David said, I did drive the exact same route to determine if the sighting might have been the result of sign reflection or other natural phenomena. No. That's why he closed it as unknown.
Right.
So it being that close to Los Alamos, it always makes you wonder. That's the reason I kind of turned to you, start thinking about, now it was back in January, but it always makes you wonder about testing things in and around that New Mexican desert whenever you get close to that area.
Yeah. So, because that's a spot where they're going to be testing.
Yeah.
Technological experimental aircraft and stuff. So if you see something odd,
yeah,
kind of makes sense that it looks odd because you're not aware of it.
You're not sure what they're
working. You see an F-18 fly over, you're like, oh, I know what that is. Yeah. I see them fly over my house every day.
And, you know, there's always speculated that they're 25 years further into the future than what we've been seeing right now with the things that they're testing.
And lots of times what people don't understand when it comes to the military and stuff like that, private contractors and stuff, they may develop some type of flying device, but they never go into production of that. They build that device to test something out. Just kind of like when you see, what do they call the car companies when they come out with these like project cars?
Yeah, the prototype
concept cars.
Concepts, yeah.
But they're never going to make that. So you'll see a concept car by Ford or something like that is amazing. Of course, you never see it in production.
Yeah, they're never going to make it.
So sometimes you might see something really odd, but they're built that specifically to test out one thing that they can later implement to other aircraft. I mean, there's a whole world of things going on.
And it may not be finally polished piece of equipment either. That's another thing.
Right. So
it's a rough version.
Yeah. So if you're near an area where they test aircraft and you're seeing unusual things in the sky, my first assumption is it's that more than something from another planet. But then again,
The idea could have been spurned from another planet. That's the old thing.
We don't know.
Speaking of don't know, folks, like we talked about, Kyle had touched on more of these crazy Mothman, Phantom, Batwing sightings and stuff that we're dealing with. So I got to digging around, and there's something I'm going to talk to you all about after the break of somebody that might have been the first person responsible for opening this portal and releasing these things. When I get back from the break, I'm going to be discussing Jack Parsons and maybe his involvement with the creatures there that's flying around and Mothman himself. So, we jump back from the break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
All right, we are back. And I guess let's just bail off into this. With all the talk and all the stuff going on of, what is it, B.O.B. wanting to GoFundMe to check out Flat Earth, and everybody going against NASA and talking about how NASA's lied for all these years, all this stuff, it just, and the Mothman sightings and the Phantom sightings, it just kind of seems fitting for all this to look back at. Kyle, you and I have talked about the patches. The NASA patches have a lot of occult symbolism in them.
Yeah, they do. And that's
kind of strange.
Very strange.
Yeah. So you start seeing all these things, and then you know that NASA's told some lies in the past, and you start looking at all this stuff. It always makes you wonder, like, you know, was it because of it, this is how it needed to be, or has it always been, or is it just little small lies that it's just like a little white lie, they call them, or is it a massive cover-up and conspiracy? So that's when I got to looking, and I remembered some of the stuff about Jack Parsons. So I'm like, I need to discuss that. We need to check all this stuff out. So I'm going to get into this and into the, I guess, the occultic roots that you could say of JPL, of the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. We'll talk about that. But also, as it has tied in with NASA, has things like that, as it's carried over. So everybody knows the names of all the different, you know, we always talk about Wernher von Braun. You can get on all this stuff. But very few people know a whole lot about Jack Parsons. So I'm going to discuss a few of this stuff. And in fact, his true name, his given name is Marvel. Marvel Whiteside Parsons. Yeah, yeah. He was the co-founder of JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, right? Which I always thought was funny because JP,
yeah,
you know, was Jack Parsons. So, and he made huge contributions to the rocket development. And what he made them in wasn't necessarily, you know, the shapes and all this, but the propellant. It was rocket fuel. That's the jet propulsion. And he, the solid rocket fuel and solid motors for all this. And as far as I know, the space shuttles, all that, I know he made them for the Minuteman missiles, were all based on technology that he himself invented. So, for those of you that don't know, he was a founding member of the Aerojet Corporation. And if you do a little research, there is on, of course, this is on the dark side of the moon. They've named a crater after Mr. Marvel Parsons, Jack. So it's funny that it's kind of like the Tesla thing, that he's not really spoken of in schools like you would think he would be, or taught about things that you would think he would be in school. And a lot of people believe it's because of the ties to occultism that he had, and that some of his views, because he's a little bit different. So we're going to get back into that Marvel was born in Pasadena, California, 1914. Now, he come from a wealthy family. But this family had a little trouble, right? A little rocky backgrounds to it, if you will. Now, I didn't tell you, but Marvel is a junior, all right? Marvel was his father's name. And after his, you know, his son was little and all this stuff, he leaves the family. The dad just bounces. He's having an affair with an old gal, and he leaves, boom, this whole thing. And it's just his mom, which Jack's mother's name was Ruth. It's just Ruth and Jack. That's it. So she's, you know, set to take care of him. So at the time, she starts, here's what's wild. She files for divorce, and she starts calling her son John, all right? Mm-hmm. Which his name, he said, even referred to by the scientific community later on in life, but so that's what it was. But as he grew older, some family members and even some close friends of his started calling him Jack, all right? Which is strange. So it's Marvel, then John, then Jack. You're like, the kid doesn't even have a given surname. You're like, well, stick with one, right?
Yeah.
So let's see what's going on. Well, he makes a good friend, a tried and true, to the bone, good friend in the eighth grade. And this fella's name is Edward Foreman. And the reason that they became friends is Edward had an Amazing Stories magazine, and Jack had never seen one. So that's what had Jack walk over and talk to Edward and hit it right off, because they were both huge fans of science fiction. Now, you can imagine that this, you know, you're talking in the 1920s. So this is something it's at a different time. So they're just eaten up with those ideas of the Amazing Stories. And they said that they would sit there and read books, all of Jules Verne's books and all this. So they believe that that's like what you and I discussed with the Dungeons and Dragons thing, is that's kind of what helps shape the person that you are. So around that time, also, these two guys get really into rocketry, and they start messing around with fireworks, launching little firework rockets, trying to build their own. They want to build their own solid fuel rocket. So, not having the rocket kits like we have at most little hobby shops now, what are they doing? They're building them like any good kid would do. So in 1928, that's what they set down and start doing, building little rockets. So neighbors start reporting into the sheriff's department in there that the backyard of the Parsons land had a bunch of burnt spots all over it, and even some craters where some of the rockets had exploded before takeoff, and that all these kids were doing was figuring out not just how to build the rocket to launch, but get a load of this. They would get the gunpowder, and they were trying to figure out how to wait, so then they started experimenting with different glues and even making their own glue to figure out some way to form pyrodex, basically pellets. Gunpowder pellets to make a solid fuel rocket. So they're in high school in 1932. So Parsons gets a job for the Hercules Powder Company. Well, you and I remember all that stuff. So they talk about the Hercules Powder Company. So he's working for them, which is a gunpowder company. So he's learning the chemistry at the time of just by proxy of gunpowder at all this stuff. So he graduates from high school in 1933. and his best buddy Foreman does too, which Foreman always makes me think of that 70s show when they talk about that. So he and Ed graduate from high school and go straight into the junior college there in Pasadena. Well, during this time, they start written letter correspondence with a fella named Robert Goddard. And Robert was one of the Rocketeers there, you know, was really big in learning rocketry and things. So they start doing all this. So they start reaching out to a lot of people. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're asking a bunch of questions. These are the people that they admire in their field. So they go deep, and he turns them to other people and other people, and they go back and forth like crazy. But what they're trying to do is get a leg up, some inside information from guys that have already been where they want to go. It doesn't really work out. So it's not like it's a yearly or, you know, several year correspondence. It's just back and forth, back and forth. They're picking brains and asking questions, much like people would send, you know, personal messages now on Twitter or whatever it is. That's what they're going now. So during all this time, of course, boys will be boys. Neither one of them, neither Mr. Foreman or Marvel, graduated from college. They left for employment. They left to go to a company there in the Mojave Desert called Halifax Explosives. So they got what they wanted. While they're working there, they, you know, find the job. Boom, here we go. Well, in 1935, a Marvel or Jack marries his girlfriend, and her name was Helen Northrup. And they got married. And they'd been high school sweethearts, you know, and this whole deal. But the marriage only lasted like 2 years. And the reason wasn't because of Jack working all the time. It was because Jack was making time with Helen's sister. She had a half-sister, and Jack kind of liked her a little bit more than Helen. So, yeah, exactly. That kind of came in. I'm sure that made for awkward family reunions on Helen's side of the family. So, you jump forward. The two friends are still working together. You know, Jack and Edward, they're still right side by side working, even in the same labs together, the whole deal. They are just hard at it. So you jump into 1937. They both decide we're going to travel to Caltech. They're given, somebody's given a lecture on rocketry. So that's where they go. So they go to Caltech. They sit there. They go through this whole thing. Well, while they're there, they bump into a fella and become friends with a fella named Frank Molina, student there at Caltech. Well, turns out Molina is studying mechanical engineering. He's also a theorist and a mathematician. So all three of them get together because he's interested in what they're doing. They're interested in what he's doing. They get together. They start asking around the campus there at Caltech about establishing a rocket development program. So they want to get the program off its, you know, get it going, grow one basically there. Well, what ends up happening at the time in the 1930s? Okay, it's still seen as fantasy, basically, to have a rocket program. You don't need one. Right. Rocketry's a joke. Where are you going to go? You can't go to the moon. You can't do all that. What do you need a rocket for?
Right.
No, this is 1937. This isn't 1950s. 1937. So they refused, like everything else. You know, no, we don't have anything. We don't care. Nothing. Well, at the Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratories there at Caltech. Okay.
Uh huh.
There's a fella that listened to all of this stuff, and this fella is if you look in aerodynamics and rocketry, this fella is like at the top of the heap. His name is Theodore von Karman. And he actually sat down and listened, and went through all their plans for using liquid, you know, liquid and solid fueled rockets, why he wanted to do it, this whole thing. They approved it, and they approved it through Molina's proposal for him to try to get a PhD in rocket design. So that's how Theodore approved this whole thing, and they got it done through one of the greatest aeronautical minds in the world ever at the time. So they was like, look, so you've got to imagine these guys, college boys, they're vindicated at this point, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it can't be any better than what's going on. So when they say, yeah, and he puts his stamp of approval behind it, well, it opens up an entire new resource for these guys now, because now the academic world says, hey, come on in. You're one of us. You know, we've got somebody supports you. So they open it up for Caltech and they all come in. Well, like I said, boys will be boys. Doesn't take long for those guys to be probably in over their heads, a little too big for their britches, and they get into a little trouble there. They misfire a rocket, and they have to, I'm assuming it went outside, but they have to move outside because it misfires indoors. So they have to move outside of the aeronautics lab there, and they have a concrete platform way away from the building. And so that's what they do. Well, not long after they got through with that one, got all that squared away, there's a little accident, number two, that caused a piece of steel to become stuck into a wall after an explosion. So it blows out, boom, sticks into a concrete wall. So Von Karman, he's like, look, guys, you can keep doing it, but you got to get away from the college. So they find a spot in the desert where it sends them out to. So he's like, now it's just y'all. But what's funny is it comes out with other students in the school, and they get nicknamed the Suicide Club. That's what the club gets nicknamed as, of these guys that are trying all these crazy fuels out, and that's what happens. So they go in this Arroyo Seco area, and that's real close to the Devil's Gate Dam, okay, there in Pasadena.
Okay.
Which is funny because that's now where the JPL site's located, is right in that same area. So they do all this. Well, in 1938, the Army offers to research. They want a couple of research projects. One of them is they need de-icing of windshields, okay, on aircraft. And another one, they need rocket engines for two small aircraft. Well, so the first college they go to is MIT. They get the very first pick. And they didn't really view, even at this time in 1938, they didn't really view, MIT did, of rocketry being something that you should be really studying into, right? This is MIT, mind you. So they're like, nah, we'll take the de-icing of the windshield. So what ends up happening? Marvel and his buddies there at the Suicide Club, whatnot, they get the rocketry stuff from the U.S. Army. They get the picket. So they get to start doing all the tests to try to get this done. So this is something that all the tested early rocket engines had powdered fuel. All right, like we talked about, they had to use glue. They had to have the contents in these. And if you don't know, folks, lots of times there's lots of contents and stuff, and gunpowder and things being one of them and things. If you mix up, you have to mix it up slowly, because over time, or even just, you know, traveling in a vehicle, it will settle out. They'll separate like milk and cream or oil and water. It separates. Well, you can't have that in a rocket. You could not put that into a rocket and then travel, especially if you were using multiple mixtures of fuel. Travel the rocket or carry the rocket somewhere, it would settle out, which causes it to be very unstable, which has how they found out by blowing up things, sticking stuff in there. There's lots of ways that you got to be real careful when you just mix any kinds of powders together like that. They'll almost naturally always separate. So that's the first thing that Jack had seen, is he's like, man, we need to develop something to fix this. Well, he had already been eaten up as a child with mythology books since he was a young boy, his mother had in the house. So he had read a ton of this mythology and gone through all of this Greek writings and things. He was a reader. What are you going to do? You know, back then in the 20s and whatnot, what do? You read. Well, it says that it's brought back to him while he's there at college, that he sees some people that are hot topping one of the building roofs. Okay. That's okay. What they're doing. And it reminded him of the readings he had as a child, of a reading called Greek Fire. And so he's like, oh, I remembered that. So he goes back thinking about using that glue and stuff. And he goes, man, I'm going to mix some of this hot tar with potassium perchlorinate powder. That's what he's going to bind together. So he's like, this is what I'm going to do. I think this is going to be the perfect binding agent to make this rocket fuel. So he starts doing it. Well, he starts noticing that it's a very clean and even burn. And not only that, but when he binds it all together with this hot tar stuff, it doesn't allow the contents inside doesn't settle out like we were just discussing. It stays bound together in a spot, which means at this point now it can be stored safely. You don't have to go in there and constantly turn the canisters over, all this. So what to do is the military sees this and they're like, dude, this guy's actually onto something here. The name of it is jet assisted takeoff. That's what they saw this. That's what he calls this canister of it. So they give a little money to him. They're like, take this a little further. Let's see what happens. So if you go into the history of missiles and into Minuteman missiles, even the Titan rocket and even the solid rocket booster that was on the space shuttle, all of those fuels are based on the original JATO canister that he came up with in college.
Wow.
So this guy is like, huh. But like I just told you, he is big into mythology as a child. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1939, he runs into a fella, starts reading a bunch of stuff here, but he comes across the fella, this, you're probably all going to know him, the Great Beast 666. I don't mean Kyle Filson, folks. I mean the most wickedest man in the world, Aleister Crowley. And for those of you that don't know, he is probably the single most notorious fellow when you bring up occult and occultism ever. Now, Aleister was born in 1875. He passed away in 1947. Now, he wrote a number of books on magic, ceremonial magic. Most of them you can still find today. And what's wild is even in these occultic circles today, long after he's dead, he is still a very big, big thing. But it is believed that he brought into a physical manifestation through a portal that they had created. It's believed that, and they believe that this entity came through this portal. And for those of you that remember or have heard, this entity called itself, Aleister said, Lamb or Lom, and he was considered to be an interdimensional being.
That's right. He kind of looked like
an alien gray.
A gray. Yeah, yes. That's what I've heard.
Yes.
Very exactly. Interesting, right?
Yes. Which is funny. At the time, the interdimensional origin at the time, that's kind of where extraterrestrial started from. That's where this whole thing kicked off. So Aleister even had a portrait of Lom in his Dead Souls exhibit there in New York in 1919. And then he'd even published a book called The Way to Crowley. And this is through Madame Blavatsky's The Voice of Silence. You go through all these things. You start looking at all this stuff. Now, Lom, which is wild here, under the picture that he had published of it, which looks like an alien gray, under the picture of it, it said that Lam is a Tibetan word for path or way, which is like Lama, you know, the Dalai Lama. And so he goes into all this. He uses some Buddhist teachings. He uses numerical value. It even spurred its own cult. So Aleister Crowley even had a cult fire up. And in that cult in the 1960s was a group called the OTO initiates up into the 70s. Yeah. And if you heard of OTO, I'm going to get into the reason why you've heard of OTO through all this. The Ordo Templarientis, or the magical order that was run by Crowley. Now, they all consider this Lam to be extraterrestrial entity, and they claim that Lam was speaking to them. That was the whole thing, that's what it was. It was nothing more than this, kind of leading their way. So there's a lot of stuff goes on. There's a lot of people goes on. You say, who is Lam? Like I said, he's considered an entity rather than an individual being. Okay, a class, which when you start thinking of classes of entities, not a single person, but a class. So anybody can speak to this group of people if you're Lam or if you're in that group. Well, it makes you start instantly thinking of, okay, if he can unlock a class of these entities, and that's what we are seeing, that all physically appear to be alien grays. What about Mothman? Right. That all these things look a lot alike if there was another portal open. Starts making you wonder. So you go through on, you start, you know, you read more about the OTO, the different entities and all this stuff. Crowley had even said, you know, that in the circles, he said he wanted to do it, but he wasn't sure if he should. And I mean, even as much as this whole thing went down. So he turned, and he actually wrote this term of he calls it intentional cultivation of spiritual growth. And he calls it the great work. And that he believes the great work is something that needed to be done. So this portal that we're talking about, Crowley believed that he opened the portal. Some people believe that it was intentional. Some people believe that it wasn't. Some of the writings, though, believe that it was fully on intentional and that he used a ritual in what's called the Alamantrath workings that allowed these class of beings like Lam to enter onto our earthly plane through a passageway. Basically what Crowley referred to as a rift in between the space of the stars. So in the blackness between the lights, you can open up a doorway. And that's where these creatures can come through. And he even said that they were cosmic and extra cosmic influences that's been known in the universe for eternity. but you just have to know how to get this portal open. And that there's also ways that you can widen this portal to allow other things to come through. So you have to imagine, what was it, Hellboy. That's what they're doing in the movie Hellboy. They're opening a portal.
Yeah.
That's what happens in the Avengers, is they're opening a portal. They're letting these things come through. So.
And like all jokes aside, yeah. I mean, like, I believe in that stuff. I think you can, if you
there's some strange stuff you can meddle with. Yeah. There's some very, very strange stuff. So, and even in, like I said, you start talking about that, the lore of these portals is pushed even further when he runs into none other than Jack Parsons, Mr. Marvel Parsons, which Marvel's Avengers. So you see how these things start kind of falling into place. It looks very strange. So they got to working on something that was called Babylon Working, which is another ritual pattern after ceremonial sex magic. Yeah, that's right. Ceremonial sex magic. Now, we can get into all this occult stuff, which I don't even know where to start at any of these things.
Let's get into the sex magic.
Yeah, right? Let's get into the sex magic. Yeah. The idea was this. And it says that that Parsons desired to take the spirit of Babylon, which was called the Whore of Babylon, and in basically put it into a human being. The idea was to create a child in the spiritual world and then call down this spiritual baby and put it into a female human's womb. And then when the child was born, it would incarnate these forces of Babylon. So how many movies have you seen to where it's along those lines?
Yeah.
A baby comes in, Christianity, a baby of virgin birth. That's what this is it gets put in there. Now, it's not necessarily virgin birth. It could be brought, but this is the idea, is maybe you even impregnate the woman and then you cast the spell on the baby and the baby gets overtaken by this Babylon. So you jump into all this stuff. It gets pretty wild after that. So we go back to 1939. Okay. So Jack Parsons and his wife, Helen. Okay. So This is join OTO's Pasadena chapter. All right.
Okay.
Which is, and I'm guessing the way all this stuff is you've got to go back to, he's not quite fully divorced yet. You remember, because he got married and then he's not, you
and then
know,
he had an affair with their sister.
With the half sister, which we're going to get to that. So he joins the OTOs there in Pasadena chapter, and it's known as the Agape Lodge, and it's led by a fellow, Mr. Smith. And anyway, so that's how he becomes familiar with Alistair. And so it's through this that he starts sending Alistair personal letters, and Alistair's like, "Ooh, okay, dude, this guy's pretty awesome." And he finds out who he is. He's like, "Okay, this guy's not just some normal knucklehead. This dude's like a genius." So Alistair and him become instantaneous friends, and so it goes back and forth. So then Jack is now a representative for the OTO. So having that, you know, this very eccentric mind to do what he does anyway, and then being fascinated with mythology, he digs more into it. So him and Crowley get going. Well, Parsons just starts getting eat up with occultism, and he starts looking at the occult side through science. So he starts basically matching them together, meshing them all together. So Jack goes and he buys this big house in Pasadena on South Orange Grove Avenue, and he creates a commune while he's there. So he gets writers and actresses and inventors and everybody to come and be part of these crazy parties that he's having there, these occult parties. And it's at this party he meets a fella named L. Ron Hubbard at this party. Now, you've probably heard this in passing and maybe not even known what it was, but the house was called the Parsonage. That's where it was located. That's where these terms come from, was the Parsonage is what they nicknamed this party house. So much so that police were there weekly. Weekly would show up. Now, you have to imagine this. If you were having parties, pool parties, and I always think of the old movie Roadhouse, where they're partying and music and girls are topless. And
the big dorky bodyguard is
trying to dance. Yeah, that guy. Exactly. That's not a big deal, right? Loud music and stuff, things like that's something that goes on routinely. Now, you don't want to go on in your neighborhood, but parties like that's not out of the norm. But in 1939, those are extremely out of the norm. Why were police called to the Parsonage, you ask? I don't know. Loud music. Okay.
Yeah.
Big fires going. All right. No big deal. They said that police were called for the consumption of illegal substances on the property.
Okay.
And one of the main problems were naked women dancing and naked pregnant women dancing all through these areas at these parties.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the police even said that every time you would go, you'd knock on the door, and that Jack himself would answer the door because they all knew that he was a scientist at Caltech. And so they'd be like, hey, look, no big deal. You know, hey, look, everything's fine. Everything's good. You know, look, we'll calm it down, this whole deal. So he would be the one. It's never like he just brushed them off like he was too big. He would go in there and use his influence at the time, and they would be like, okay, just hold it down. You know, nope. So nobody went to jail, although they probably should have. Nobody went to jail. So at work, you would think that it would start unraveling for him when he's partying like this. But no. It's exactly the opposite. He starts basically taking his occultism ideas and the things he's learning from Crowley and all this, and he starts piling it and pushing it. And so he has, it's like he's found his own religion now. So he has this newfound confidence, and it's showing in his rocket developments. It's growing and growing. There was a dance and a chant that's called the Hymn to Pan.
Oh, please.
And I don't know it. I'm not going to sing it for you. But Jack would sing it before every launch test of his rockets.
I sing a similar song, but it's called Ham when I'm making a sandwich.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Or toast. Toast is the most. I like the toast song. So he would do all this dancing and singing before he launched his rockets. So that's how invested he was. And look, does it sound crazy? Yeah, but it's if you view it as a religion, then it's no crazier or more normal than any one religion. It's just that's this guy's religion at the time. So what's funny is nobody even cared. The guys that did it, they all, even Von Karman, who had all this government funded and all this stuff, he was like, he's a little odd, but he is a super great guy.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Yeah. So as long as he gets the job done, what do I care?
He's not hurting anybody. There's nothing going crazy. We'll just do all this. So in 1941, we're going back to the Suicide Club, they had successfully demonstrated functionality of the JATO canister, and then the U.S. military put one of the boosters on a small aircraft, ignited it, and it, boom, everything was, right? Everything. So, and it allowed the aircraft to actually take off in half the distance. That's how powerful it was. So they were so impressed that they placed a large order. So the funding exploded. So again, there in 1942, the Aerojet Engineering Corporation was founded. That's what it started to make those JATO canisters. Well, in 1943, they start looking at this like, huh, you see what this rocket project could be. The military took over operations in 1943 because of that, and they changed the name to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Now, they're not researching jet engines. It's a concept of rockets, you know, was still a little bit shaky at the time. So that's the reason that they had to have this name, Jet Propulsion. So that's what they went with. It's nothing about rockets, even though that's how it's propulsed. That's how it's pushed up, is through the propulsion of a jet. That's just kind of the way that they went around it. So now it's under military control, okay, at this point. Boom, this is what it is. So they start using JPL to get a few weapons systems. You know, they start using a little, you know, solid fuels and some liquid fuels, and they have Parsons in the middle of it. And, I mean, he is just going hard in the paint, figuring all this stuff out. So then World War II ends, okay? So World War II is over, and they take one of those V-2 rockets from Wernher von Braun, and they slap one of these canisters in it and get it all done, and they achieve an altitude of more than 70 kilometers. It's the very first American rocket to ever exit Earth's atmosphere. Okay, that's the very first one. Boom. So during all this time and during the war and all this stuff, of course, some of the military guys are like, we can't really have our head propulsion guy being viewed at as a crazy occultist, right? This dude's just, he's a little out there. So some guys come to him and they say, hey, look, we don't want what you do is fine, okay? We don't care at all what you do, but we don't want it reflecting badly upon us and this whole thing. We need to know if we can pay you off. We want to buy your shares of the Aerojet thing and pay you off, and then that way we can kind of take your name off of part of this. You still work for us. You're still paid for. You have all the freedom you want, but you're not like under the spotlight. Is that cool? Yep. Well, Jack's like, yeah, dude, that's cool. Go ahead. Hook me up. So what do? They pay him a large sum of money. What does he do? Well, he goes full bore into crazy spiritual sex parties. Okay? So Jack goes overboard, goes wild. Well, right before, like we said, remember we talked about the half-sister of his wife, Helen?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So
that's who he's with now.
That's who he's with at this point. Well, it was right before the war was over and all this stuff, and right before the big payoff, Helen finds out that Jack's been having an affair with her sister, Sarah, which she goes by Betty, that Betty Northrup.
Not good.
No. So Helen's like, okay, two can play this game. Well, you remember the guy over there that was the head of the OTO, Mr. Smith?
Yeah.
So Helen bounces with Mr. Smith. So this whole thing's pretty wild, right? You're like, huh. So Smith leaves. So when he leaves, well, Jack Parsons becomes the full head of the OTO there in Pasadena. And then he lets it be known that he's in an open relationship with Sarah, with Miss Northrup, his new lady friend. So in 1945, what ends up happening is Jack Parsons shows up with his lady friend there and ends up meeting up and having some drinks with and hanging out with Lafayette Ronald Hubbard, L. Ron.
Right.
Yeah. Well, L. Ron, of course, charms the pants right off of Parsons. So Parsons is like, this dude is awesome. You know, this L. Ron Hubbard is the bomb. So he's part of my group. He's one of my homies. So he brings him in. Well, Aleister Crowley can't stand him. Has no use for L. Ron Hubbard. Now, Parsons has even been quoted into saying that I deduce that he is in direct touch with some higher intelligence, talking about L. Ron Hubbard. This is what Jack Parsons said, and that he is the most thelmic person I have ever met and is in complete accord with our own principles. So he invites L. Ron to live at the parsonage and then gets initiated into the secrets of the OTO. So Jack brings L. Ron in. Crowley hates him. Crowley's like, this dude's a fraud. He's nothing more than a trickster. Everything he says is to just make a little money and to make the best life for himself.
Well, and he's probably right.
Probably. He's dead on. Right. That's exactly what happened, what he was. Well, Parsons didn't believe it, like we talked about this whole deal. So he brings him in, becomes part of that Thelmic belief system where they worship what we talked about, Babylon or the Scarlet Woman. So Crowley and Parsons, they believe that it is possible to summon this spirit of Babylon into a human form using sex magic. And this is where they get the referral to this name as Moonchild, because they believe that they can create this Moonchild. So in 1946, from the month of January 1st to mid-March, Parsons began a series of these magical rituals with L. Ron Hubbard, and it's known as Babylon Working. And after, so here's the set of rituals they have to complete. Then Parsons is met by a woman named, I'm going to mess this up, but her name is basically Marjorie, and she is kind of like a hippie chick, right? But in the 40s, she's pretty wild, pretty out there, this whole thing. She had actually moved there because she was in the Navy, in the military. That's where she had first heard of all this stuff. She got an honorable discharge and then moves to this area because she wants to be part of this. Well, she is a scarlet red-haired woman, which instantly is what he thinks of as this is the one. This is the one that we've been waiting for this whole time in this ritual. So he, being Parsons, Jack Parsons, loses it for her. He's in love with this woman. This is the woman that we've been waiting for this whole time. He believed that her finding them was him summoning Babylon, the Scarlet Woman, coming to see him. Well, around this time, all of the Aerojet money that he spent, he's been living on, or that he made, he's been living on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He is destitute. He's bankrupt. He's broke. Jack Parsons is out of money. No moss. He's done. That's it. Well, good thing for him, he's got a buddy that makes a lot of money. And, you know, you can kind of imagine what he's doing, but who really knows? But his buddy is L. Ron Hubbard. He's very, very good with money. Now, the scheme that L. Ron Hubbard was running back then was that he would buy boats and sell them at profit. Now, he had also claimed, you know, to be a Navy captain and all. Remember, he used to wear all the captain stuff. And so that's what he would do, is he would buy these boats. And then what he would do is he would give Jack $20,000 to Hubbard, and then Hubbard would go and collect a boat. Anyway, it was one of those things. It was kind of a real circle of you pay me, and then I'll get, and then little things kind of didn't fall into place, and it was basically robbing one guy to pay one guy and then shifting money around and all this stuff. So it instantly wasn't right, okay?
Yeah.
But Parsons had this money, so Parsons is like, okay, we need a boat. We need to, you know, L. Ron needed that boat, right? So, like we said, it was in buying boats, and then you flip them. You turn them over for profit and all this. So L. Ron says, okay, I'm going to take my naval experience, and I'm going to go get Jack a boat, and he and I are going to go get a boat together. So Jack gives him 20 grand, and I'm going to go down to Florida and get the boat. That's what I'm going to do, you know. Then I'll bring it back around here. He's going to, I guess, I don't know if they were going to drive it back or if how he was intending to getting it there, but, or if he was just going to go get it and wait for him to get down there. So Jack Parsons hands him the 20 grand. He's like, here you go, man. Go get it. He's waiting around, looks around, and he's like, man, where's my wife? Oh, that's right. My wife ran off to Mexico with L. Ron Hubbard. Yeah, they both took Jack's money and bounced. Yeah, so L. Ron was pitching woo on Jack's wife at the time. Well, that's when L. Ron completely quit talking to Parsons. None of that stuff. That's everything. So he's like, huh. So if you go into further, it is said this, that Jack Parsons invoked magic, cast a spell on L. Ron Hubbard, and then had a thunderstorm engulf the boat and then force them to land where the law was waiting for them. And that story is how it really happened.
Wow.
A huge thunderstorm forced them back into port, which is where he'd already filed charges on them for them to be arrested for theft. So, look, Parsons got his money back, but he lost the boat. And he lost his wife, but he got the 20 grand back. Okay, now 20 grand back then is probably quite a bit of money. And he ends up marrying Marjorie, the Scarlet Woman. Well, during all of this, you know, he's slowly sliding down, you know, worse and worse and worse. He loses his security clearance. So he has small jobs. Get a load of this. During all this, he loses security clearance. He's designing polytechnic explosives for Hollywood movies. Okay.
Uh-huh.
He's repairing washing machines and things on the side to make money. Because he took that buyout, he quit working for them. When they bought him out and he left, he just was like, there's no reason for me to stay here. You know, I've got all this money. I don't need to work. So he left that job. It's not like he stayed working. He left that job and was partying like a rock star till he ran out of money. So he ends up getting a job for Hughes Aerospace. All right. So he's working for them as a chemical researcher. And it's a very, very good job. But in 1950, the FBI began investigating Jack Parsons for the theft of some documents from Hughes Aerospace. And that they believed, and they found out, that Parsons had planned to exchange these rocket plans with a newly founded government at the time in 1950. And it was for admission into this government. And this government was Israel. Mm. He was going to give these rocket plans to Israel.
And Hughes being the company owned by Howard Hughes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in the original FBI report, it even says that he planned to submit these documents with an application for employment over there, and he was going to work for this company in the new country of Israel. So the U.S. Air Force tells the FBI, and this is actually, you know, how it goes through, and then they go through this whole thing. They start monitoring Parsons again. They see that he is still, you know, now mind you, this is 1950. Aleister Crowley is died in 1947. So this is a few years after Aleister is dead. So you jump forward. They realize that he had an extensive relationship with him and that he was believed to be part of a perverted sexual cult is what they believed that Parsons was involved in. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So he's back to having, now he's had his security clearance completely revoked. He's on the watch list of the government. He can't do anything, right? And he's completely penniless. I mean, he is destitute at this point now. Nothing. In 1950, L. Ron Hubbard releases the first edition of Dianetics. And that's how it all starts into that whole thing of Scientology. And then that's where the symbolisms of OTO is to go clear for this new religion that he was involved in, which is what Jack Parsons and him told him, right?
Right.
Crazy enough. In 1952, Jack Parsons was 37 years old, and he's in, I'm assuming a workshop of his own. Okay?
Yep.
There are two loud explosions, and Jack Parsons is dead. Now, there was a few hours that he suffered from his injuries before he died. Now, there are some theories that surrounds this about his death. Some say it's an assassination. Some say it was just something accidental. But many, many believe that it was an experiment with his wife, you know, with his Scarlet Woman,
mm-hmm.
to open that portal and to bring in these things, to bring in, because they believe that he had learned from Crowley when he opened up the portal and let in Lamb, or let in that class, that he was looking for revenge. That Jack Parsons was looking for revenge, not just against the people who had wronged him and outed him from his business, but against L. Ron Hubbard, against a lot of people. A lot of people that he had believed, and they believed that he had been taught by the greatest man that could have taught you how to open these portals, being Alistair. So that was his way of getting back, and that they believed that it opened up and maybe he saw or something he couldn't control. He tried to close it, and then that's when the explosions started. They don't really know. Some think maybe he just got careless and he was just old and he was crazy and he just mixed something up. Nobody really knows. Now, there's some other crazy stories that go along. On the same day, after Jack Parsons' mother, Ruth, heard that Jack had been... Now, mind you, he was the only child, right? He was a solo child. After she heard of his death, she overdosed. She overdosed and killed herself. Now, there's a story that goes around that that some police investigators and stuff were going through the Parsons home, you know, this whole deal and going through all the stuff, and that they found an old box, and they got this old box open, and in this box was a film, like a reel-to-reel film, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it is said that it was showing one of those occult gatherings in this reel-to-reel film, and in this film was Jack's mother Ruth, and he was having relations with her on film.
His mother.
That was the whole thing. So it is at that point that they believe that everybody said, okay, this guy was a crazy person, we don't care what he did. They went in and they start wiping it clean. They pull his name off of any and everything that they can find stored academically wise at Caltech. And he even became footnotes on technical papers. So his name was no longer in the heading. It was in the footnotes. And then over time, they started just leaving him off of footnotes, too. They wanted to basically make him out to be a crazy person. But it all boiled. And I'm not saying he wasn't a crazy person. I'm saying that maybe he did open this portal to let out these creatures. And I have a list of strange sightings that happened around space centers that happened around these times of black winged men before Mothman was ever seen.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm talking like from 1953.
Let's hear it.
Okay. I'm going to lay this on you. In the wee hours, here's one that took place. It takes place in Houston, Texas. In the wee hours of the morning on June 18th, 1953, something very strange was sighted in Houston, Texas, which happens to be the home of the Johnson Space Center. But with the heat and the humidity still hanging in the night, you can imagine how hard it is to sleep pre-air conditioning.
Okay? Yeah.
So at 118 East 3rd Street, very little sleep was possible because of that very reason. So a 23-year-old housewife named Hilda Walker was sitting on her front porch with two friends and neighbors, a 14-year-old Miss Judy Mayer, and a local tool plant inspector, 33-year-old Howard Phillips. Now, Hilda Walker went on to say that 25 feet away, I saw a huge shadow across the lawn. I thought at first it was the magnified reflection of a big moth caught in a nearby streetlight. Then the shadow seemed to bounce upward into a pecan tree. We all looked up, and that's when I saw it. Now, she goes on to describe this entity. It's basically man-like in shape, and she says that it's got a pair of bat-style wings, and it was dressed in black, and it was a tight-fitting outfit. Now, that's what she says, a black tight-fitting outfit. But she goes also to say that it's surrounded by an eerie glowing haze. Now, all three of them confirmed that this thing stood about 6.5 feet tall, And they all said, yeah, they saw this strange glow around it and that it was yellow in color. And they go on to say that this bat-like creature, when the light slowly faded out, it vanished in this light. But she said at this time, now this is a little girl, Miss Mayer, says that she heard an ear-splitting scream. Now Hilda goes on to say, immediately afterwards, we heard a loud swoosh over the housetops across the street. It was like a white flash of a torpedo-shaped object. Now, I've heard so much about flying saucer stories, and I thought that all those people were telling stories that were crazy, but now I don't know what to believe. I may be nuts, but I saw it. Whatever it was, I sat there stupefied. I was amazed. Now, little young Miss Meyer was even told, even added, of course, in the newspaper there, that I saw it, and nobody can say I didn't. Now, the older fella there, the 33-year-old Mr. Phillips, that was the tool plant inspector, he didn't just bust right out, but he said, I can hardly believe it, but I saw it. We looked across the street and saw a flash of light rise from another tree, and it took off like a jet. Now, they go on, you start talking about this. Here's what's wild is our buddy and our good friend, Mr. Ken Gerhard. Ken has even gone down there to try to find this house, you know, and look for all this stuff. He's not been able to find the house because it was torn down. And there's some other things, you know, and stuff was built up around there. But there are some very, very strange things that had happened down there that you can find other reports. There's also, there's another story from Frank Shaw told the story. And he is an archivist that worked at NASA's, their Johnson Space Center in the 1980s. And his daughter, Desiree, tells the story of what ended up happening, and it's very, very interesting. And basically it says that it was late one night in 86, and Frank had returned from his routine there at work at the Johnson Space Center. Nothing, you know, was particularly unusual about him being late. So, you know, it's no big deal. And the daughter's like, yeah, Dad got home late. And it's just sometimes he has to work, you know, later into the night, you know, doing what he was doing. So it's nothing. But he said a few things were a little different. Now, like I told you, this was in 86, okay, when all this went down, was 86. So it's this well after the Mothman, but still, it's we're talking about in Houston. So she said that her and her mother, you know, they're talking about all this, said the father was really having like an anxiety attack, okay?
Uh-huh.
Like something bad. She's like, I could tell when he got home that it wasn't right. And Dad was having like a full-blown attack, like he's falling apart. So the mom and the daughter that, you know, Desiree, that tells this story said that they got him to calm down. And when they finally got him to calm down, they said, what happened to you? What, you know, were you almost in a wreck? Were you robbed? What happened? And this is what he tells is he said, while I was walking to my car, said, I saw something. And he said, it was a complete and utter horror. I didn't know what to make of it. It was perched on a nearby building. He said, I saw a large man-like figure, black in color. And he said it seemed to have a large cape kind of draped across its shoulders and across its back. But he said it was two huge wings that was sticking out there. He said they were appendages. Huh. And he said they were on each side of this cape. So it's wearing a cape with wings coming out. And he goes, those wings looked more like a bat than a bird. And he goes, what's really odd is they made like this crackling noise as they flapped. And he said the wind was strong, and it's strong, and it looks like a gargoyle. So that's a thing that he had said he'd seen. Now, he said he was frozen, that he could just stand and stare when he saw this. He said what he was looking at, I could feel the evil to my core with what I was seeing. He said the reality just faded away. It couldn't be what I was seeing. It couldn't be real. He said, but it was looming. You ready for this? Right over him, sitting on the top of NASA's Johnson's Space Center.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's sitting on the top of it. So now there's multiple buildings, but there's one large building down there. And he said it was sitting right where he came out, looking down there at him, this whole time just staring at him. So it does make you wonder at this thing, too. Now, it's been reported that there were some dogs in the area that had been killed. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. So Shaw instantly said, he's like, look, dude, I know we're not going crazy. You know, he's like, I know exactly what I saw. So it eat on him and eat on him and eat on him. So finally he goes to his supervisor, his superior, and he's like, hey, man, I need to know, you know, I'm not going crazy. This is what I saw. And the supervisor was like, hey, dude, don't worry about it. That's not the first time it's been seen here. And he's like, dude, what? Well, apparently at night, some of the security guys have even talked about seeing it, and that there's parts of the Johnson Space Center that you can go where this thing has been seen more than others. So like I was talking about, whenever they found the remains of these German shepherds, it was security dogs and these things. And he's like, it's not like it's been like a mountain lion or somebody did it. It looks like something legitimately tore it to pieces, these dogs. So that wasn't the very first time it was spotted. And from what I know, it wasn't the very last time it was spotted. But it does make you wonder, did Jack Parsons do something to where he cursed these creatures and they were released? Maybe they started out around the space program. Maybe that was the idea, or at least around the rocketry program, the propulsion program. Maybe that's what started it out, is that. But now he's never got to close the portal. Or maybe he got it closed. Maybe he opened it before and that explosions were to close it. I don't know. We have no idea. Maybe it goes along the same thing as that witch that says she opened them up in that area there in Chicago. Maybe a lot of this stuff has the thing, but maybe you fall all the way back to the occultists and these things of Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons. Maybe they are the ones responsible for these things.
Maybe.
So it's
crazy.
Right? It's really crazy. It's really unnerving. So, folks, I hope y'all enjoyed it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll wrap this puppy up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Very interesting, folks. We're back. A very interesting story, Cam. I had no idea that there were so many people involved and how it has ties with things like NASA and also cryptozoology, the occult. You talk about these secret societies and these secret meetings with the Bilderbergs and stuff, and it makes you wonder, Aleister Crowley and... Excuse me, something. I must have swallowed a bug or something. But I had no idea, but you start looking at it, and they kind of go together, and it's really bizarre. I mean, what is going on?
I love the fact his name's Marvel.
Yeah, there's so many similarities.
Yeah.
I mean, like you mentioned, the very, very beginning of the segment about the way that the missions, the NASA missions were named and the symbology that's associated with the patches for each one of those flights. And there is a lot of strange stuff going on. I remember originally I watched a documentary years ago by Jose Escamilla called Moon Rising or something. And that was the first time I was introduced to, you start looking at like all the Apollo missions and you start looking at the symbology in there, but date back to ancient Egyptian symbology and just weird things with numbers, symbols, those strange shaped chevrons. It is bizarre. And then to talk about people there at the Johnson Space Center actually seeing gargoyle type beings perched on rockets and things.
Yeah.
I had never heard of that before. That is crazy, and especially with this time of year, I guess Halloween. I always think of like Ouija boards and the occult and stuff.
I always want to know how many of those have been sighted like that, those few little sightings that have come out where people have let slip. But I always want to know how many of those have been sighted at some of these NASA areas, but that nobody's saying anything.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how many of these secret people in private are having these seances and trying to open portals, or are in fact opening portals.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's where all this weird stuff we see. Maybe every time someone sees a Sasquatch, every time someone sees a Chupacabra, every time someone sees, I don't know, a flying griffin, that this is something that has come through a portal that's been created by some people just fooling around, or who knows what, or trying to get revenge. But
I don't know. I have no, but it just, I don't know.
Oh, man. Speaking of something else you don't know, I don't know what this fellow's been thinking. You know who Justin Smeha is, right? Have you heard of that name?
Yes, I know exactly who that is. That's a man that claimed he killed a Bigfoot.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I remember all that.
Well, apparently he's in trouble now. He's 31 years old, and he faces felony charges of perjury and filing a false or forged instrument with the state.
Uh-oh.
He's been apparently taking deer illegally and falsifying bear tags, and he's in trouble with the game service there, because he's been, I don't know what he's been doing. He's been playing around with tags, hunting deer and bear tags, and apparently he's in deep trouble now. He was arrested on Saturday. Now, he has made bond, which was $20,000. I don't know how he got that kind of paper together so fast, but it looks like old Justin Smeha is in a lot of trouble. So,
good.
It brings into question, anytime you meet a guy that's willing to lie and try to cheat the state, taking animals illegally, it brings up a lot about someone's character.
Mm-hmm.
Because an honest hunter is going to do things the right way. And when I bring up his characters, what I'm saying is this reflects a lot on his alleged stories about killing Bigfoot, because this guy obviously is a crooked hunter as well.
Yeah.
So it starts to lay out a real good description that this guy's probably full of it.
Well, they did that DNA and they were like, it's a bear.
Yeah.
Remember? And the guy even goes, do you want to tell me the real story? Do you want to tell me the truth of what really happened out there?
Yeah. And
he's one of those dudes that I don't think he thinks the whole story out. He was just like, I'm going to tell everybody I did all this. I'm going to get famous. He never thought somebody's like, you know, they're going to DNA test anything they can get their hands on to try to see what it is.
Exactly. Right. So that's pretty funny. I saw on Instagram, you sent out a picture of a movie ticket.
Yeah, I did.
And we had talked about it on the Elite Show about the new Blade Runner movie. So I know that you went and saw it. I wanted to get your thoughts real quick.
Did you like the first one?
Yeah, I did. I liked the first one.
You're going to love the second one.
Oh, it's good? Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Man, I'm going to tell you what. I do this a lot. I don't watch the trailers. If I know I want to go see a movie and I see a trailer pop out, I quit watching it. I will go out of my way to make sure I never see a trailer, because I don't want to be alerted to anything. I want to go in there and sit down and actually experience it. I feel too many times that when they release a show like that, you watch the trailers, it ruins the movie for you.
Yeah.
I did not do that, and it was amazing. Everything in this movie, I'm so happy with the way this movie turned out. Like, it was great. You have to see it. Folks, I urge you, if you are a true Blade Runner fan, you're going to love this movie.
Even if you've never seen the original, you know, if you're just into science fiction or something, I suggest you go online and rent the first one.
You need to see the first one before you watch the second one. That's one of those things that it's a must. But yeah, if you've never seen the first one, do yourself a solid and watch it. It's a great flick. And then go watch the second one.
You know what I like? My favorite part about trailers is when you see a trailer and you see something that's really cool in the trailer, then you go watch the movie and that scene never happened.
It's not in there.
You're like, what happened?
You're like, what are y'all doing? What?
Yeah. Well, before we get out of here, folks, let's talk about our sponsors, KGRA Radio. We're over there now on Monday nights. So cool to be a part of that. Also, Gaia, that's G-A-I-A. They are a video streaming service with over 7,000 titles. They have one-of-a-kind programming like Eric Von Daniken's Beyond the Legend, Unearthing Nazca, Hidden Origins with Michael Tellinger, False Flags with Richard Dolan, Deep Space, Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe, and Beyond Belief with George Norrie. Also, they have videos on yoga, Pilates, and fitness, meditation, alternative health, spiritual growth, and documentaries like UFO, The Greatest Story Ever Denied. But you got to get over there, folks. If you sign up now, your first month is 99 cents, but you got to use the code. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Also, book of the month, get your first book for $10 at bookofthemonth.com/expanded. That's bookofthemonth.com/expanded. If you have a story of your own you would like to share with us, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828, and you can follow us on all forms of social media. Don't forget, if you want more of Expanded Perspectives, you need to sign up for Expanded Perspectives Elite. By signing up, you'll get an additional show every Friday, as well as access to the entire back catalog. Signing up is easy. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Well, that's about it for this show. For you elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Friday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you again next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hick.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.